we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let us begin with local stories, starting with a criminal investigation.
Yeah, the State Patrol will lead a criminal investigation of Seattle Police Department officer James J. Lee, who was caught on videotape kicking an African-American teenager who was trying to surrender to him. This videotape was one of the many instances of police abuse that the ACLU had cited in their letter to the Department of Justice requesting that the Federal Department of Justice lead an investigation against the Seattle Police Department. Well, Chief Diaz is trying to run interference here and take what is the most egregious case caught on videotape and have an outside department lead an investigation. What's interesting to me is that the State Patrol looked at the tape and immediately they said, okay, criminal investigation, not any other kind, not a civil rights violation or anything, but a criminal investigation, which I think is kind of interesting in two respects. First of all, they assume that it's criminal assault, which anybody looking at the videotape would make that assumption because it's just
unless you work for the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah.
Then you don't make that decision.
And they rule out any kind of civil rights violation. They don't view it as a racist incident that because this was an African American youth, even though he had his hands in the air trying to surrender to the police, that the undercover agent still kicked him in the groin. After the kid fell to the ground, he then kicked the kid in the side and in the face, which is pretty bad. They didn't assume that had anything to do with the fact that the kid was an African American youth. So I found that kind of interesting. But even more interesting to me was the response by the Seattle Police Department, head of the police guild. He said immediately, oh, we're going to file an unfair labor practice because we don't understand why Chief Diaz gave this investigation to an outside agency. It should be done in-house.
Yeah, where it can be properly whitewashed.
Yes.
All right. Anything else on that?
Just to point out that, yet again, response by the Seattle Police Department is endemic of a culture, and it goes back to Mayor McGinn and his decision not to hire somebody from outside the Seattle Police Department. And one of their finalists had a much stronger record about confronting these kind of abuses and setting a leadership example that would hold officers accountable for this type of behavior. McGinn opted to go in the other direction, and we're seeing the fallout from that.
All right. Moving on, looks like Seattle has a new partner.
Oh, yeah. The state chose Seattle Tunnel Partners to build the downtown Seattle traffic tunnel, the tunnel that's supposed to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct. The bid came in just a hair under budget at $1.09 billion. The budget was set at $1.1 billion. It's almost as if the Seattle Tunnel Partners just kind of pulled a number out of the air and said, well, we gotta squeeze it in under the budget. How close can we get, you know? So, of course, it leaves not very much of a margin for error or for cost overruns. And this is after the state already gave contractors $255 million from the $415 million reserve fund in order to help them reach that budget amount, which, again, only leaves about $160 million in the reserves. Clearly not enough.
So it didn't actually come in under budget at all.
Exactly. So if you add that to the $1.09 billion, it's over budget already. Which has been pointed out by City Council member Mike O'Brien. He said, look, aren't we already over? You know, I can add. If nobody else can add, I can add. and I think that's true. You know, when they start piecemealing it and reporting this amount and that amount and this other amount over here, it's a way to kind of hide the costs from the public. And they're already doing it before the construction begins. What are they going to be doing once the construction starts?
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay, let's move on. You're not the only ones working today. Apparently the state legislature is working today as well.
Yeah, this weekend, the state legislature is meeting to try to close the gap in the current state budget. It's about $1 billion, that gap. And Chris Gregoire, earlier this year, made some across-the-board cuts. She announced some across-the-board cuts to try to close that deficit, but the deficit kept growing. Her cuts equaled about $200 million. And so the legislature has to come in and find another $800 billion, either in cuts or raise revenue. Of course, the raise revenue idea is completely off the table.
Even though the shortfall to begin with is a result of lack of revenue, it's not a result of excessive spending.
Yeah. And, you know, this week, the Wall Street Journal published an article looking at state budget problems and how that's been a major drag on the economy and the economic recovery that analyzed which states had the worst budget deficits. And Washington came in pretty high on the list. We were up there in about the third or fourth position of states that have high budget gaps. And a big reason for that is the structure of our budget revenue sources. The fact that we don't have a sustainable revenue source for the state budget. We don't have a state income tax. We have instead sales taxes, which are heavily dependent on how the economy is going and how much money people are willing to spend during a downturn. That just, when a downturn comes, that just plummets through the basement.
And even beyond that, what we're taxing in terms of sales tax is a declining share of the actual state economy. That as a percentage over time, you know, the financial services sector and other services like that that are not directly taxed through sales tax are growing, and retail sales are falling. So that over time, you're going to get a shrinking portion of the state business, you know, the state economy that is taxed for supporting the state government.
Yes, and this main feature of this economic downturn has been a fall in property values. Now, when you've got a fall in property values, the property tax portion of the state revenue goes down as well, and that's true for local revenue too. And that's just, as Job mentioned, that his other aspect of the revenue problem, that's a threefold whammy there for the state. So instead of trying to look for a way to stabilize state revenues, the legislature has got that completely off the table. They're looking at the expense side of the budget only. Gregoire proposed that they make major and very deep cuts, including cutting out completely the state's basic health care plan and the state's portion of disability payments, putting the onus almost completely on the state's poor to cover the state's budget shortfall.
And as you both have pointed out in the past, there's also that large corporations like Microsoft that don't appear to be paying their fair share.
Yeah, they're not even looking at closing some of the big revenue loopholes that could help them close that budget gap.
Yeah, and even last year, a new one worth over $1 billion was set aside for Microsoft in terms of their out-of-state licensing of software. But the interesting thing about this is that the disproportionate share of the budget cuts are falling on the poor, even though the way our state taxes are structured, that also disproportionately affects the poor. So the poor are paying far more than they should in terms of taxes, and they're the ones getting hurt by the lack of services that are being cut from the poor. So in effect, what you have is a massive transfer of wealth. The rich are not paying what they're supposed to be paying, and then they're not paying their fair share. They're certainly not paying nearly as much as a percentage of income as poorer people are paying in this state, and then they're just continuing to receive a disproportionate share of the benefits.
Yeah, and that's being mirrored on the federal level as well. We'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Oh, yes, we will.
All right, moving on to national. Terrorist of the Week.
Yes. Apparently it's a new feature, Terrorist of the Week.
Show on Fox.
Yeah. You can get trading cards, too. They have the really hard sticks of bubble gum that come with them.
Yeah. This week I want to talk about the 21-year-old homeless Maryland 21-year-old homeless Maryland kid, Antonio Martinez, who was caught in an FBI sting trying to blow up a military recruiting center. Once again, the first conversation he had with an FBI informant was not recorded, of course, so there's no evidence showing that he approached the FBI informant, not the reverse. And, of course, the FBI is admitting that, yes, they made the bomb, the fake bomb. They gave him the SUV with the bomb in it. They helped him plan the attack. They gave him a cell phone because he didn't even have a cell phone. And then after he had parked the SUV, an FBI informant picked him up and drove him to a vantage point where he could set the bomb off. So
using his extensive know-how in bomb making.
Yes, and he even admitted in recorded conversations he had no experience and he did not know how to build a bomb, and he was completely and utterly clueless. So why did the FBI consider this guy a threat in the first place? I mean, he had tried to recruit friends to help him with the attack before, and was completely unsuccessful in that. Two of his friends immediately said, "No way, man." A third one tried to talk him out of it, and the fourth person he asked turned out to be an FBI informant, and that's the person who said yes. So, you know, this really illustrates how the FBI is wasting taxpayer money going after people who really are no threat, who may have an idea that they wanna stage some kind of attack, but they have no experience, they have no training, they have no ability to do so, but the FBI is using taxpayer money to help them realize their violent dreams.
And it's not just that they're wasting taxpayer money, although they're doing that. They're specifically spending that money and exploiting these very vulnerable people in order to perpetuate the idea that the war on terror is an imminent menace, and in order to justify a lot of the civil liberties takeaways that we've experienced over the past several years.
Yeah, and to spend a lot more taxpayer money on the surveillance state.
All right, moving on. Tax cuts. That's what they've been talking about
Get your tax cuts over here. Yeah, the Obama administration announcing this week that it had reached a compromise deal with the congressional Republicans to extend the Bush tax cuts. Now, the elements of that compromise, there were a number of them, and Maria will go through them in a minute. Well, why don't you run through first what the actual details are?
Well, it will extend the Bush-era tax cuts. The Democrats have made a big deal about how the estate tax will be reimposed, but at a much, much lower rate and on estates worth over $5 million so that the ultra wealthy will have to pay almost nothing when they die, and how this is a terrible thing. But it also extends what I think is probably the worst tax cut in history, which is the 15% dividends and capital gains rate. If you really look at the 15% dividend capital gains rate
tax, which
is
a much lower rate than normal income is taxed at.
Yeah, normal income is taxed. I mean, normal income for a middle-class American is taxed at a higher rate than 15%. The 15% capital gains and dividend tax rate, everybody was happy when that was passed because ordinary Americans thought, oh, then my investments, I won't have to pay a higher tax on my investment. What they didn't realize is that the wealthy don't have ordinary income. Most wealthy people do not work for wages. They do not have to pay a 36% rate or a 39% rate or whatever it is their income tax bracket is. They pay only the 15% rate because their income is made up almost entirely of dividends and capital gains. And what that does is it basically subsidizes folks who are professional investors. Well, when those professional investors accumulate more and more and more money, as we're seeing, as the poor pay more in taxes and the poor pay more for goods and services, and there's this massive movement of money, redistribution of wealth from the poor to the very rich who are mostly professional investors, what that does is it means within the society you have a huge pool of money at the top looking for ways to make more and more money, going after riskier and riskier investments that are not tied to the real economy. It's money that doesn't create real jobs. And that money is looking for more and more and more income that will be taxed at the 15% rate. So you have people investing in hedge funds, investing in risky venture capital. A lot of times economists will say, well, venture capital is good because it spurs new business. But think about Pets.com, for example, and other companies that were part of the last two economic collapses. You have to really ask yourself, is that money that's doing real work, or is that money simply in search of more money to be taxed at a lower 15% rate? In essence, the federal government, by having a 15% rate on capital gains and dividends, is really subsidizing professional investors at the expense of all the rest of us who work and pay higher taxes on our ordinary income, on our wages.
Now, we've seen this week how Congress has been stalled and continues to be stalled, even with the even with the reaching of this particular compromise, continues to be stalled on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on the New START treaty, on a number of the different issues that had hoped to be accomplished and gotten through the Senate and through Congress during this lame duck session. But even with this, while Obama did get some compromise from the Republicans that he didn't. That people didn't think he would be able to get. There are a number of ways in which this compromise is strategically extremely disadvantageous, not only economically, but also politically as well. You have only 1 year extension of unemployment benefits, for example, and that's only for people who have not exhausted their current benefits, for people who are already at their maximum of 99 weeks, who've been chronically unemployed for nearly 2 years now. Their benefits will not be extended, so they'll be left to fend for themselves. There will be no additional help there. That was only extended for 1 year, whereas the Bush tax cuts were extended for 2 years. Now, what does that do? A lot of this spending that's going to be inserted into the economy, whether it's for the unemployment extensions, whether it's for some of the other spending that was reached under the compromise, will only last for the year 2011. That money will be inserted into the economy, and that creates almost the exact same dynamic that we had in 2009-2010, where the stimulus money that came in during the first year of the two-year federal election cycle, creating it's not enough to help with a bad economy. It's not nearly enough compared to the dire straits that the economy is in, but it will create slightly better conditions than we would have seen otherwise in 2011. That money, the effects of that money, will decline, particularly over the second half of 2012. So you've got an economy declining again right in the months leading up to the presidential election and federal election in 2012, which is exactly what Republicans want.
And I just want to say here at this point that all economists pretty much agree that tax cuts are the least efficient way to stimulate the economy, that they have
absolutely a
minimal effect on stimulating the economy, particularly when they're weighed so heavily in favor of the very wealthy.
Yeah. But the second part of the political timing on this is not only is it the most disadvantageous to Obama and the Democrats for the 2012 economy, but you then have, assuming the Republicans then do relatively well in the 2012 election, they will be in a position in 2013 when the extended tax cuts of the Bush era expire to make those cuts permanent and to extend them into other areas as well, because they'll have more control in 2013 when those cuts expire. So it was a very, very bad deal politically in terms of what we can expect in the future, both in terms of the how the economy plays out and also in terms of the politics of what future tax cuts are done and what the Republicans have the capacity to do.
Yeah, and you know, the very small aspects of this agreement that might help lower income people, like a 2% break on your Social Security or your payroll taxes, those things will give lower income people a very, very tiny boost in their income compared to what the wealthy get out of it. It really was a very bad deal.
Yeah, yeah. Obama $40 here, $3 million there. What's the difference?
Yeah, yeah. You know, Obama really should have faced down the Republicans and said, "No, I don't agree to this. It's up to you. If you come back in January, you don't extend unemployment benefits, and you want to, you know, institute a huge tax break for the wealthy, then you're going to have to face public rage. You know, and if you pass a bill that has those features to it." If you pass a bill that extends all of the Bush era tax cuts, I'm going to veto it. He should have held his ground.
Well, this is the other way in which it was damaging politically, is it reinforces the meme, and we've seen this time and time again, where Democrats don't fight for their principles. They cave. And that is exactly what Obama did in this case. He gave the Republicans almost all of what they wanted in exchange for a few benefits here and there. And he did it without really going to the public and making his case. And in fact, at his press conference announcing this, he announced the deal as the best of all possible worlds and made a point of criticizing those critics in his own base who are criticizing the deal rather than criticizing the Republicans for, you know, shutting down Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he did say, you know, the Republicans are taking hostages here. You know, they're taking the unemployed hostages.
And he negotiated with the hostage takers.
Yeah. Instead of being tough and saying, well, you've done that, you should take the blame for it. You know?
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. That moves us on then to international and this week's developments related to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, for those people who missed it in the 8 o'clock segment, Glenn Greenwald had an excellent interview on Counterspin regarding WikiLeaks. I would highly recommend people who didn't catch that to go back in the podcast and catch it at the KEXP website. But Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, arrested yesterday in Great Britain on Swedish charges that nobody's ever actually really seen yet. So we don't know the details of that case. We do know that WikiLeaks supporters around the world are treating this, as WikiLeaks itself is treating this, as a politically orchestrated arrest. And in fact, the United States, there's a lot of speculation that the U.S. is also considering trying to file charges against Assange, although it's really not clear what law has been violated. Certainly he's not doing anything different than, say, the New York Times or some of these other international agencies have done. He's taken things that have been leaked to them and publishing them. And there's ample legal precedent for saying that that's completely legal, the Pentagon Papers being the most operative United States Supreme Court decision in that case.
And let's be clear, too, on what they actually published. They weren't publishing highly classified documents here. They were publishing lower-level cables, things that news organizations, when they get their hands on it, routinely do print.
Yeah, it's been really quite revealing, and Greenwald goes into this at some length, just how obsequious the United States media class has been, and how relentlessly they have parroted the official line that these are on the one hand extremely damaging revelations that will hurt United States diplomacy and security, and on the other hand, oh, there's not really that much there. Just don't look too carefully at that. Let's move along now.
And
can't have it both ways.
Yeah, and talking too about, gosh, look at these. It shows these guys are really professionals. They're good writers. You know, you're talking about the cables
they're covering up war crimes, but they're doing it really, really professionally.
Yeah, but what the cables actually do when you print them all together like that is they give you an overall view of the big arc of U.S. foreign policy and its effect in the world and how and whether we get along with the rest of the world community. And that's something that, of course, that the federal government would like us not to know and not to pay attention to. And that's a big part of this whole brouhaha over the WikiLeaks documents.
Yeah, so as a result of all of this and the U.S. pressure of WikiLeaks and whatnot, we've got really the first modern cyber war going on, in which a very, very loosely organized group of cyber warfare activists and hacktivists and so forth are trying to get payback, as it were, against a number of the companies and corporations that, as a result of the United States pressure, have tried to shut down the WikiLeaks site. So you've got Visa and MasterCard, the Swiss bank that froze their account,
Amazon,
PayPal, all of these different corporations that have been trying to shut down WikiLeaks, even though WikiLeaks has been charged with no crime, and even though it's not even a United States entity. One of my favorite pieces of this has been the United States congressman who actually accused Julian Assange of treason. It's like, don't you have to be a U.S. national in order to betray your own country?
I think you have to be a U.S. citizen.
But so a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the actions against WikiLeaks have been way over the top, and as Greenwald mentioned, something that you couldn't imagine taking place against, say, the New York Times for basically doing the same thing that the Times has been doing. In fact, the Times has been publishing many of these same documents and analyzing them. But so we're seeing now the pushback against that, and it really raises very basic questions around not only freedom of speech and constitutional protections for people who haven't been accused of any crime, and it's not really clear what crime they could be accused of, but it's also really, really instructive how completely media has closed ranks and turned against people for the crime of gas publishing information.
Yeah, the foreign press is very interesting to read on this subject and very entertaining. I mean, you have British correspondents saying that the American media and the American politicians' response to the WikiLeaks documents is bordering on the deranged. You have the Russian government and the Russian media having a happy field day saying,
and Chinese also
saying this is what you get in the land of free speech, you know.
Well, and not only that, but there's this rich archive of speeches of Hillary Clinton criticizing the Russians and the Chinese for their efforts to control the internet, and now the United States is doing essentially exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and all the foreign press has to do is quote these speeches by Hillary Clinton and then laugh about how ironic it is. And then of course you also have the issue of what this kind of highlights to me is that the internet is perceived by many people to be a free public space, when in fact we are seeing revealed in the way in which these companies have denied service to WikiLeaks and tried to shut down their website, that really
and done so with really no legal documentation whatsoever that would justify it.
Right, that the internet really is a commercial space, that it's really owned and managed and run by these corporations, and that the WikiLeaks activists are trying in their assault on Visa, MasterCard, Amazon, PayPal, the British version of PayPal, etc., that they're trying to take back that space and make it possible to be a free public space again. And they're trying to kind of reveal how much the internet has become a commercial area owned and managed by corporations. And they're trying to say, look at how terrible this is. And there are ways that we can take it back.
All right. That just leaves us a couple minutes left to talk about the UN climate conference.
Yeah, the climate change conference taking place in Cancun, of all places, a city that would not exist were it not for, you know, modern international air travel and its resulting climate emissions. So it's kind of an ironic place to have a climate change conference, but they did reach an agreement last night, a very lukewarm agreement after 2 weeks of negotiation to extend the deadline for extending Kyoto. That's right, they agreed to extend the deadline for extending Kyoto by 1 year. That coming also with an agreement for $100 billion in climate-related aid to poor countries. Left unresolved, of course, is what the source of that aid will be, or language that will make any kind of extension or any kind of use of that aid legally binding. Also this week, Russia joining Japan and announcing that it will not recommit to Kyoto-level emissions and protocols. That along with the U.S. and China sniping over how to enforce monitoring of climate emissions, really casting into doubt what the future of climate change negotiations will be at a multilateral level. The good news in all of this is that a number of countries are starting to take individual steps without waiting for any kind of international framework to try and curtail climate emissions or greenhouse gas emissions. And that may be the wave of the future, because it looks like these negotiations are going to continue to be very problematic moving forward.
Yeah, much of that is driven by an effort to boost these countries' economies by investing in the green sector, because China has already taken the lead on that, and everybody sees themselves as having to catch up.
All except right. The United States, of course.
Yes.
Events.
Yeah, today is International Human Rights Day, a good day for directed denial of service attacks. There's also a march today from noon to 1 o'clock from Hing May Park, that's at King and Maynard, to downtown Seattle. Also today, MP George Galloway will be in town, a prominent critic, among other things, of the Israeli actions in the Israeli-Palestine conflict. He will be at Embassy Suites Bellevue at 3225 158th Avenue Southeast, speaking along with Charles Swift and others for the Muslim Legal Fund of America. An RSV is required for the event, and you can find out more information about that at www.mlfa, that's for Muslim Legal Fund of America, www.mlfa.org/RSVP. So go to that site if you want to see George Galloway tonight.
Right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is at www.eatthestate.org with local and national and international news and opinion and humor and whatnot. And as we mentioned last week, we are compiling our annual overhyped and underreported stories of the year list for the end of the year. If you've got nominations of that, of stories you think are ridiculously overhyped or haven't been getting enough attention, drop us a line. Email us at editorial@eatthestate.org. Thank you.